sharks were no help. I was up a creek without a paddle, and had been since 4 a.m. Nuno came in from the living room while I was washing pots and kissed me on the cheek. "Doing good, sweetie?" he asked. "Fine," I muttered. And then I lost control and started crying. He was, reasonably, completely flummoxed. He turned off the faucet and hugged me and asked, "Did I do something?" "No," I cried into his shirt. "I can't value a company. I've spent hours on this. Hours! And I can't sit down and know what those formulas are and use them. When I think about what to do, my head spins." He paused. "I think you're getting so worried about this because you're trying to remember formulas instead of truly understanding them. You know my memory. Do you really think I remember all these formulas?" When he was working from my house while visiting me in Boulder, I had seen him write down and use the most complex formulas from memory. "Yeah, I definitely think you remember all the formulas. You pull them out of your head like they're nothing." "No," he protested. "I don't remember them. I think about the problem and use logic to determine the tool I need to get my answer. I don't actually memorize the formulas. You have an extremely logical mind, so if you think the process through with logic rather than thinking about the formula, you don't need to remember them. The formula will come automatically when you need it." I pulled away from his wet shirt. "I could do that." "Yeah," he was warming up to his own idea. "Forget that this is even about math or a formula. Use logic to get from where you are to where you're going. And then you won't need to get all worried over the math. You just need to understand it, and then it will come." I suddenly remembered how I learned math in school. I was always confused while in class, but once I figured out that I should pretty much ignore the class, take the textbook home, and teach it to myself, I did fine. I taught myself all of my high school math that way. Nuno was saying that I should look at evaluation method as pure logic. That way, when I get the eventual answer using that method, I'd know if the answer was correct or if something went wrong in the process. Valuation would not beat me. I would teach it to myself, somehow. So, I got back to Charlie. Fourth principle. We're not going to pay an infinite price. So simple and so obvious? Foin. I would turn this current 6-foot bar into a 6-inch bar. I would teach myself valuation, and I would buy a company. Hell, if my dad could do it, surely I could do it. I had to believe that, for me, my dad could translate his numbers brain into a words brain. I left Nuno happily typing away on work stuff in the living room and sat at the kitchen table. Later, I video called my dad. "My confidence is at an all-time low on this. Can you show me the easiest way to value a business that exists on the planet? If you can do that, I will figure out how to teach it to myself." He said, "Great minds. I've been rethinking how I should teach novice investors a different way to find the right price to buy the business." "Really?" I squeaked. "Yeah, I've sort of realized I'm so familiar with the process of running numbers through my formulas that I forget it's intimidating if you're not comfortable with that language. I've thought of a much better way to explain it. Let's go to the feet of the master." I felt my body involuntarily relax. Wonderful. My dad started recapping Buffett's 2014 letter to his shareholders, in which Buffett spelled out the simplest possible way to put a price on a business. Buffett is fantastic at explaining business concepts to us normals, and this was what I needed. Nothing complicated, no toaster-sized book on valuation, common sense methods. In his letter, Buffett said to think about pricing a business like pricing a real estate purchase. I know, not exactly in the same category as the public companies I had been researching, or the public companies Buffett was buying. But the real estate business rents space in a building. It requires only a few numbers, all of which I had used when I bought my condo. Purchase price, maintenance costs, how much I would have otherwise had to pay in rent, taxes, insurance. Even if I don't exactly find them fascinating, I can connect real estate numbers to something tangible. I know why I'm using those numbers, where to get them, and how to tell if they're off from where they should be, Just like I can understand why a Toyota costs less than a Lexus and why Lululemon yoga pants cost more than leggings from Target. The same is true for some public companies, says Buffett. I appreciated my dad so much for finding Buffett's real estate explanation and offering it up. I had missed it the first time I read the Buffett Bible. I used Buffett's example to start to learn my dad's three ways to price and value companies. Yes, three ways. I wasn't happy about it either initially. At that moment, one method was all I needed. One was all I wanted. Having three different ways to get at the price forces you to understand the company better, and the better you understand the company, the easier it is to choose the right price to pay, my dad explained. You should be able to see any manipulation in the financials by understanding and comparing them. Three methods make you safe. Well, that was an excellent answer. I like safe. All right, I acquiesced. Let's do it. Three methods of pricing or valuation. 1. 10 cap price, based on owner earnings. 2. Payback time price, based on free cash flow. 3. Margin of safety valuation, based on earnings. A note about math. Remember, if I can do this, you can do this. To make learning the math easier, I offer you three examples of businesses. First, a real estate example of a rental house, the rental house. Second, a private company example of a lemonade stand, the lemonade stand. And third, a public company example of Whole Foods. The rental house and the lemonade stand numbers are clearer, less complicated, and more accessible than going straight to public company numbers. Each sample business's financial statements are also available in full in the appendix in your enhancement PDF. Early in my practice, my dad emphasized that I should look and act as though I were going to buy a whole company. And in pricing, we take that literally by pricing the entire company as a whole. Yes, I know public companies are traded in shares, and I'm not really going to buy the whole company. I don't care. And actually, I might buy a whole house or a whole private company someday. Laying the groundwork of understanding these whole company examples will make it a lot easier to understand how to know what to pay for one share of a public company. So please bear with me. This is how I learned to be relatively comfortable with accounting and financial statements. Then, once we have the concepts, and only then, we will discuss purchasing a fraction of a company using publicly traded shares of stock. Pricing method number one, 10 cap. In that 2014 letter to his shareholders, Buffett described how he determined what to pay for two of his businesses, a Nebraska farm and a building in New York City. Buffett used a pricing method that real estate investors call capitalization rate, also known as a cap rate. Buffett and my dad love using cap rates because they think they are simple. Here's how I understand them. Essentially, a cap rate is the rate of return the owner of the property gets each year on the purchase price of the property, the rate of return being the money the owner puts in her pocket. For example, if I buy a house for $500,000 and get $50,000 in my pocket at the end of the year, the rate of return on my investment is 10%. That's my cap rate, 10. If I get only $25,000 in my pocket at the end of the year, then my rate of return is 5%, and that's my cap rate, 5. Basically, the higher the cap rate, the higher my rate of return, and the less I paid for the property. A higher cap rate is better. Capitalization rates can vary, often from a 4% capitalization or 4 cap, a 4% return on the purchase price each year, to a 15% capitalization or 15 cap, a 15% return on the purchase price each year. Buffett and Munger require a 10 cap rate, a 10% return on their investment per year. And therefore, my dad calls this pricing method the 10 cap. Warren Buffett makes his calculations based on a financial number he defined, owner earnings, the amount of cash that can go into the business or real estate owner's pocket every year without affecting business operations. We'll get to calculating owner earnings soon. First, the farm. In the 1970s, crop prices were rising with inflation, and Midwestern farm prices exploded upward. There was a feeling among farmers that if you didn't buy a farm now, the price would be insanely high in a few years and you'd never be able to buy one. So prices kept going up. Small Midwestern banks made loans on these farms as the farm prices continued to rise. Then, in the early 1980s, the Federal Reserve Bank raised interest rates extremely high, which made it more expensive to pay a mortgage, so farm prices started to fall. The high interest rates also brought inflation down to earth, and crop prices started falling. In a couple of years, the price of a farm dropped by 50%. Farmers started having trouble making payments on their high-priced land investments, and foreclosures skyrocketed. The small banks all over the Midwest that had provided the mortgages started failing, and eventually hundreds of them, along with their foreclosed-on farms, were taken over by regulators. The regulators operated the farms marginally while they tried to sell them. So, here we had a major event going on that was crushing the price of a farm. This went on for years. From his prime location in Omaha, Buffett noticed. He found a 400-acre farm that had a moat. It was located in a unique area, Nebraska, where the combination of soil type, rainfall, and sunshine created a kind of durable competitive advantage over other farms in the world by providing the conditions for a reliable yield of corn and soybeans. He knew that he could hire professional farm management who would increase the farm's output back to its historical pre-bank takeover days. He knew that the farming industry was going through an event. The corn and soybean prices in 1986 were the lowest in multiple decades and would very likely be higher in the future. In other words, he knew that in 10 years or so, this farm would likely be more productive and making more money than it was that year, and would likely be worth quite a lot more in the future. He calculated the farm's current, not great, revenue, subtracted the expenses of growing and harvesting the crop, including replacing equipment as it got old, maintenance capital expenditures, and got the resulting owner earnings. In this case, it was about $28,000 per year pre-income tax. So, what price did he think made sense? Dad asked me. You're gonna like this math. He was willing to pay a price that would give him a reasonable return on his money. He simply multiplied the annual owner earnings of the farm, $28,000, by 10, $280,000. If he got the farm for that price, the $28,000 of owner earnings meant he would get a 10% return on his investment in the first year. That's a good, solid return. And he was likely to get a much higher one in the future as owner earnings grew with higher crop prices and better production. So he offered $280,000 for the farm. And he bought the farm. Not figuratively. Literally. The formula for the 10 cap, then, I reiterated to make sure I had it right, is owner earnings times 10. It tells me the price I can pay that will get me a 10% return from my first year of owning it. About buying that farm, Buffett wrote, quote, I needed no unusual knowledge or intelligence to conclude that the investment had no downside and potentially had substantial upside. There would, of course, be the occasional bad crop and prices would sometimes disappoint. But so what? There would be some unusually good years as well, and I would never be under any pressure to sell the property since there is no debt to force a sale in a bad year. Now, 28 years later, the farm has tripled its earnings and is worth 5 times or more what I paid. I still know nothing about farming and recently made just my second visit to the farm. End quote. Buffett was saying you should feel confident you can make a rough estimate of future production, and if it will be higher than today, then buy the entire house, farm, company, whatever, for a price that is 10 times the current owner earnings. You should get a 10% return on your investment to start. And if you're right about the business having higher production in the future, you are very unlikely to lose money on that investment. Dad then described Buffett's second example, the rental building. In the mid-1990s, Buffett found a building in New York that had gone into foreclosure during the savings and loan real estate debacle. And no one wanted to buy it because the previous owner had leased its space well below market rates. He did the math. If he could buy it for a 10-cap price, he would get a 10% return until he could raise the rent, after which the return would go through the roof. He made the offer at the 10-cap price and got it. And then after just a couple of years, he was able to re-lease and then refinance the building, taking out 150% of his investment and leaving the building revenue to cover the mortgage. Today, that building is worth many millions more than he paid for it. All right, I thought. I see how this math works. This method will determine a sensible price to buy the company, a price that is very likely to be substantially lower than the real value of the company. Wait a minute. A 10% return the first year? That's a great deal. How often do 10-cap deals come around? Yeah, my dad answered wryly. That is the catch. You could literally wait 30 years to have a 10-cap rental building in New York or a farm buying opportunity like Buffett got in Nebraska. What's the point of this pricing method if 10-cap deals are so rare? 2 points. One, they do come along, and I've done some of them. You may not realize this, but the house we built in Iowa, where you saved my legs, was on a large farm I bought in 1986, at the same time that Buffett bought his farm in Nebraska. And I bought it for the same reason. It was super cheap. Then I split it up and sold it off in lots that paid for our house. I did know that, actually. I figured it out when people started building houses all around us. I didn't know you had gotten a great deal like that, though. But if it's true that the deals don't come along very often, then how am I supposed to ever find deals that I can actually buy at a 10-cap price? Well, 10-caps might be hard to find in real estate and farming, but in Buffett's 2014 letter, he goes on to tell you why looking for 10-caps in the stock market is a lot easier than finding them in your local real estate listings. He then turned my attention back to this passage from Buffett's letter. There is one major difference between my two small investments and an investment in stocks. Stocks provide you minute-to-minute valuations for your holdings, whereas I have yet to see a quotation for either my farm or the New York real estate. It should be an enormous advantage for investors in stocks to have those wildly fluctuating valuations placed on their holdings, and for some investors, it is. After all, if a moody fellow with a farm bordering my property yelled out a price every day to me, at which he would either buy my farm or sell me his, and those prices varied widely over short periods of time depending on his mental state, how in the world could I be other than benefited by his erratic behavior? If his daily shout-out was ridiculously low, and I had some spare cash, I would buy his farm. If the number he yelled was absurdly high, I could either sell to him or just go on farming. Buffett was saying that the stock market moves based on other people's valuations, and the resulting price they're willing to pay varies so much, it is liquid, because trading is much more susceptible to short-term emotions like fear and greed, and that creates many more buying opportunities based on your own valuation. Just because of that, investors who are not swayed by emotion can capitalize on regular opportunities to buy wonderful businesses at great prices. The 10-cap price was an anchor for me to know what an exceptional price for a company would be. Deals show up like Nordstrom's semi-annual sale. You're never really sure exactly when it's going to happen, but when you get the email, you know it's worth checking out. Companies are not on sale at a great price all the time, but there are regular times when they are a deal. When there's a recession every 5 to 10 years, and when there's uncertainty in an industry or company. Whenever an industry is out of favor or an event happens, prices drop, fear builds, and sometimes really good companies go on sale for a 10-cap price. This is the advantage Buffett is talking about. The mere fact that there's massive trading going on daily in the stock market makes the prices go up and down much faster and with much more volatility than ever happens in the real estate market. Dad summarized. It's the nature of the market itself that makes it possible for us to find 10-cap deals regularly, instead of once in a lifetime. The seemingly incomprehensible movements of the market that I had been so worried about and afraid of from the very beginning were actually what would create a perfect opportunity for me to buy. Apple was a 10-cap deal for a few weeks recently, for example, my dad cited. Did you buy it? Yep, and so did Buffett. I really got it in that moment. I got how this whole rule number one investing is supposed to work. There's a certain remove from the insanity of the marketplace that the rule number one investor has, and suddenly, I felt it. That sense of remove felt pretty good. I was separated from all the petty speculating and ups and downs that characterize the financial industrial complex. I felt kind of above it all. The second reason to use the 10-cap pricing method, my dad went on, is owner earnings. Owner earnings. It is not provided on standard financial statements, but it is made up of numbers from those statements, and it is an extremely useful number. It's going to give you the closest approximation to the funds you have available to you as the owner of the business, without adversely affecting business operations. Owner earnings is very important for Buffett because he owns a large number of private businesses that produce a huge amount of it. Owner earnings is allocated by the CEOs of Buffett's companies to maximize the amount the company can send to Buffett to invest. This is where he gets so much cash to allocate each year. I have found that owner earnings is very important to me too, for a couple of reasons. Crucially, it's much harder for bad actors to fudge the numbers in owner earnings than it is in net profit, because there's nothing projected, expected, or anticipated in them. Owner earnings is about the cold, hard cash that the business is producing right now, not in some foggy future. When we base our buy price on the owner earnings, we avoid the problem of precisely figuring out how the business will be doing in 10 years. As long as it will be doing better than now, and we can get a 10-cap deal, we're good to go. I liked that. A lot. In his 1986 letter to Berkshire shareholders, Buffett said owner earnings is, quote, the relevant item for valuation purposes, both for investors in buying stocks and for managers in buying entire businesses, end quote. Since Buffett thinks this is such an important number, and because my dad feels all the feelings about the perfection of Buffett's formula, I'm going to put his definition down verbatim. Owner earnings represent A, reported earnings plus B, depreciation, depletion, amortization, and certain other non-cash charges, less C, the average annual amount of capitalized expenditures for plant and equipment, etc., that the business requires to fully maintain its long-term competitive position and its unit volume. Excuse me, Warren, while I go scream, where is Uncle Charlie when I need him? However, it's not as bad as it sounds. My dad simplified the formula for me and showed me on which lines of the financial statements to find the numbers. We've written the formula in real-life words, which I'll say in a moment. Our formula for owner earnings, along with our three examples, are also available for reference on the PDF. On a typical cash flow statement, net income is the very first line under cash flows from operating activities. Depreciation and amortization, which is a non-cash expense to account for the declining value of certain assets, like the depreciation of a car, is the next number down. Footnote. A non-cash expense is an expense deducted from income that did not require the payment of any cash that period. Still in that same section, there will be a line or a group of lines about net change in accounts receivable and accounts payable from the previous year. Accounts receivable is when the business is owed money by its customers, and accounts payable is when the business owes its suppliers money. As these numbers change year to year, the change either puts money in the owner's pocket or takes it out. That is, it can be positive or negative. Each number indicates only that change. His formula for owner earnings, along with three examples, are also available for reference on the PDF.
Formula for owner earnings, Net income. Watch out. These numbers could be positive or negative, but you always add them. Plus depreciation and amortization. Plus net change accounts receivable. Watch out. These numbers could be positive or negative, but you always add them. Plus net change accounts payable. Watch out. These numbers could be positive or negative, but you always add them. Plus income tax. Plus maintenance capital expenditures. Negative number. Yes, this does say to add a negative number. It's not a typo. It's like that because of accounting standards. Equals owner earnings.
We also add the income tax that we find on the income statement because we're valuing a business the same way we value real estate, with owner earnings before we pay our income tax bill. Maintenance capital expenditures is the tough number here because, maddeningly, companies are not required to separate it out from total capital expenditures, usually called purchase of property and equipment. Maintenance capital expenditures represents the money spent on the long-term stuff that has to be replaced just to keep the business going. In the rental house, it's stuff like the roof shingles and HVAC every 15 years, the appliances every 7 years, and exterior painting every 5 years. In a business with well-kept financial statements, the number for maintenance capital expenditures will be described in the cash flows from investing activities notes to the cash flow statement. However, since many companies do not break out maintenance capital expenditures in their notes, we have to understand the business well enough to estimate the average annual cost. I look for notes that describe the capital expenditures and purchase of property and equipment expenditures for growth, things like new restaurants or a new production facility, and separate those amounts out, my dad explained. We're just focused on what it costs in cash to keep things running. Worst case, I use the full purchase of property and equipment number, and take note that it's a larger number than it should be, and that I may not understand this company as well as I should. I tested owner earnings out on the rental house, which, like the lemonade stand, is an example my dad and I invented because it's easy to understand. The rental house is a house bought with cash. There's no mortgage on it, for the purpose of renting it out. Owner earnings for the rental house. Net income, $28,000. Plus depreciation and amortization, none. Plus net change accounts receivable, none. Plus net change accounts payable, none. Plus income tax, none. Didn't pay it yet. Plus maintenance capital expenditures, negative $4,000. Owner earnings, $24,000. Owner earnings from the rental house is easy to calculate because we're using cash accounting. I subtract all the normal expenses of a landlord from the rental income to get the net income, and then subtract the average annual cost to replace the major stuff. What's left over is owner earnings in my pocket to pay off student loans or buy more real estate. Now, let's do this for the lemonade stand. The only maintenance capital expenditures for this company is replacing the juicers every 3 years. In the following table, I note where I found each number in the lemonade stand financial statements in the appendix. Owner earnings for the lemonade stand. Net income, $2,000. Where to find it? On the income statement or cash flow statement. Plus, depreciation and amortization, $1,000 from the cash flow statement. Plus, net change accounts receivable, negative $300 on the cash flow statement. Plus, net change accounts payable, $100, cash flow statement. Plus, income tax, $500 from the income statement. Plus, maintenance capital expenditures, negative $500 from the cash flow statement notes. Owner earnings total, $2,800. Once you know which numbers to use and where to find them, the calculation of owner earnings is simple. Just look them up on the lemonade stand financials and plug them into the formula. Owner earnings are the owner's money, pre-tax, which the owner can spend on the company to build the business, buy other companies, distribute to herself, in a public company in the form of a dividend, buy out partners or shareholders, or leave in the company as a nest egg. If I owned the entire rental house or the entire lemonade stand, I would get to decide what to do with the owner earnings. If I shared a company with someone else, we would decide together. If I owned a small part of a company, I would leave it up to management to decide what to do with the owner earnings. That's what happens in public companies. As we learned in Chapter 3, the shareholders, as the owners of the company, technically own the owner earnings. But shareholders, by voting for the board of directors, appoint management to run the company on their behalf. The board then decides, on the shareholders' behalf, what to do with the owner earnings at the end of the year. We'll spend an entire chapter on how owner earnings are typically used by public companies. For now, what we need to know is that the concept that the owners get the owner earnings is the same for every company, real estate property, or farm, whether it's public or private, and regardless of how much of the company an owner owns. My dad treated every company as though he were going to buy 100% of it, even if he wasn't, because it gave him simplicity and clarity of thought. He had been teaching me to think of a public company as if I would buy the whole thing, and pricing was no different. Price the whole company, then decide later how much of it you want to buy. This method worked for me and brought me to the point of owner earnings, pricing the business. That math I could handle. I took the owner earnings for the rental house and the lemonade stand and multiplied each of them by 10. The lemonade stand was a steal at $28,000, and the rental house was a bargain at $240,000. Got it. Nuno had been right about internalizing the logic of the formula. Once I understood the logic of it, I could summon it at will. 10 cap for the lemonade stand. $2,800 times 10 equals $28,000. 10 cap for the rental house. $24,000 times 10 equals $240,000. Once I got into doing the work of calculating owner earnings and using them in pricing a business, any business, including real estate deals, I understood why the great investors like Warren and Charlie do the work of calculating these numbers themselves. I closed the video call with my dad and sighed, happily, with deep relief. I flew back home to Boulder a few days later. It was deliciously comforting to walk into my home in my own beautiful space with my investing office laid out on the dining table. It was Sunday, and it was blistering hot. I splurged on an iced coffee from the expensive coffee shop down the street before coming back to sit at my investing office. The artisanal coffee definitely helped me steel my brain for what was to come. Practicing pricing all by my lonesome. I tried figuring out owner earnings for Whole Foods. This was the test, I realized, to know if I had studied the company well enough so that when I read the footnotes to the financial statements, I could confidently come up with my maintenance capital expenditures numbers. If it was too hard, that meant I didn't understand the company well enough. In that case, it would be officially too hard, and it would be time to move on to the next one. Here are the relevant numbers from Whole Foods' 2015 financial statements. 2015 was the most recent 10K when I researched Whole Foods. Owner earnings for Whole Foods. Net income, $536 million. Where to find it? The 2015 cash flow statement, line 2. Plus depreciation and amortization, $439 million. Where to find it? 2015 cash flow statement, line 4. Plus net change accounts receivable, negative $21 million. Where to find it? 2015 cash flow statement, line 14. Plus net change accounts payable, $20 million. Where to find it? 2015 cash flow statement, line 17. Plus income tax, $342 million. Where to find it? 2015 income statement, line 10. Plus maintenance capital expenditures, negative $335 million. Where to find it? 2015 cash flow statement, line 24, other property and equipment expenditures. Owner earnings total, $981 million. Once I had the formula from Dad, finding the right numbers was easy. They were right there. To find maintenance capital expenditures, all I had to do was search for capital expenditures in the Whole Foods 10K. And I found what I was looking for in an obscure note called non-GAAP measures on page 22 and on the cash flow statement. It took 4 clicks and less than 30 seconds. And that was the hard part. I plugged the numbers in just as I found them on the cash flow statement and income statement, positive or negative, and then did the addition and got $981 million for the 2015 Whole Foods owner earnings. Once I knew the owner earnings, the 10 cap was simple. I multiplied the owner earnings by 10 to get the price to pay. 10 times 981 million is 9,810 million, or 9.8 billion. That's my buy price for the entire business. The 10 cap for Whole Foods is $981 million times 10 equals $9,810 million. Woohoo! I can do this! As my concern that I would never learn to price a company subsided, my missions came to the front of my mind. I wanted so badly to vote with my money, but I wouldn't do so blindly. If I voted with my money for a poorly run company, my investing funds would eventually disappear, and I'd be stuck without any votes, or retirement, left. The struggle I had just gone through to learn owner earnings would get me to a good price for a wonderful company with a worthy mission. I dialed my dad and exultantly yelled my results into the phone. I understood this pricing language, which, out of the entire language of investing, was the most difficult for me to wrap my mind around. He laughed happily. Then he upped the ante. With the 10 cap method, we assumed the owner earnings would at least stay the same each year and give us a minimum 10% return pre-tax, a 10 capitalization rate. It keeps the math simple for finding a good price to pay. But we only buy businesses we understand well, with great moats and management that, crucially, are going to grow. Oh dear, I saw where he was going with this. Growth. My friend, the windage growth rate, was back. While we can put a price on a great company with the 10 cap, there are two limitations to that method. The first is just that Buffett's definition of owner earnings is, obviously, pretty ambiguous in spots, and determining the appropriate number for maintenance capital expenditures may, for many companies, be only an educated guess. So good investors may come up with slightly different 10 cap numbers. The second limitation is that the 10 cap doesn't take growth into account. Buffett would probably argue that that's a strength, but using the 10 cap, two businesses with the same owner earnings, whether they're growing faster or slower than each other, would be priced exactly the same. Growth wouldn't matter at all. But we know that, all else being equal, a company that is growing its cash faster will produce more cash in the future and is therefore worth more today. The 10 cap, in its conservative glory, does not take that into consideration. But the payback time pricing method does. Pricing method number 2. Payback time. The payback time method is used by investors to put a price on a company that they're not going to sell for a long time. What they want is a fast return on their investment, so their risk of losing money disappears. Rather like a gambler taking his money off the table and playing with house money. What my dad calls the payback time is just what it sounds like. The number of years it takes to get your whole purchase price back. In this pricing method, the purchase price comes back to the buyer from another non-GAAP view of cash flow, called free cash flow. We'll explain soon, but first, the payback time formula. The payback time formula is free cash flow, grown by the compounded windage growth rate for 8 years. It's clearer with an example. I practiced again, this time the rental house. The rental house is in a nice spot, probably by the beach somewhere, where more and more people want to live. Rents typically go up in growing towns 3 to 4% per year, while my expenses would roughly stay the same. I wanted to be conservative, So I made its windage growth rate 3% per year. I multiplied each year's free cash flow by 100% plus the windage growth rate, going out 8 years, and found the 8-year payback time. If you want to view the year-by-year breakdown, it's all written out in the PDF. The price I can pay for the rental house is $219,819. And if it grows as expected at 3% per year, I will have all my money off the table in 8 years. Why is 8 years the magic number? Uncle Charlie thinks that a fair price is about half of what the same company would sell for as a public company. And public companies sell for about 12 to 20 years of free cash flow, or about 16 years on average. Half of 16 is 8. The difference between public company price and private company price is liquidity, a measure of how easy it is to sell ownership of a company. It can be hard to sell off a piece of a private company. That investment is illiquid. Public companies, by definition, are trading on a stock exchange and are much more liquid because of the high volume of trading, the regulation of the stock exchange, and the largely reliable financial reporting enforced by the government. Fund managers don't want to own a public company's stock for very long. Their need to trade quickly means liquidity is extremely important to them. They have to be able to sell off a big chunk of stock fast, and they're willing to pay quite a lot more for that. About double, in fact. Warren and Charlie don't need liquidity, though, and aren't willing to pay up to get it. A payback time of 8 years or less is a sensible price for a wonderful private company. And I shouldn't pay more than that for a public company if I want to invest like Warren Buffett, Charlie Munger, and my dad. I would have already figured out the windage growth rate for a given company earlier in my company research. This is where the work you did on understanding the business, the moat, and the management comes in, my dad explained. If the business has a big moat with a durable competitive advantage that protects the free cash flow from getting cut down by fierce price competition or loss of customers to some new product, then, by definition, the future should look quite a lot like the past. And if the business is run by talented, honest management, then they probably won't screw up the moat. From your understanding of the business, you're going to estimate how much it will grow its free cash out for 8 years. If I can theoretically get my money back from free cash flow in 8 years, that's a pretty good deal for a wonderful business. The key was that I choose businesses that are easy to understand, skip the ones that are too hard, and apply my mission, moat, and management analysis to this price calculation. It was really nice to connect back to the non-math parts of this practice, especially when they could support my understanding of the mathy bits. Now, on to free cash flow. Footnote. Dad wrote an entire book about the concept of payback time that became his second number one New York Times bestseller. In that book, he used net earnings in the payback time calculation because it was more easily available. But now, we are using free cash flow instead because it's more accurate. Free cash flow has certain advantages, Dad started. There is no subjectivity in determining the free cash flow numbers. Some companies include it in the notes to their cash flow statements. It has growth capital expenditures baked in, and stock research websites show it, so you can check your number against theirs. Well, that sounded fantastic. Compared with owner earnings, free cash flow is crazy simple. Here's my dad with the formula.
Formula for free cash flow. Net cash provided by operating activities plus purchase of property and equipment, a negative number, plus any other capital expenditures for maintenance and growth, also negative numbers, equals free cash flow.
About one-third of the way down on the cash flow statements is a bold line called Net Cash Provided by Operating Activities. Below that is the section titled Cash Flows from Investing Activities. And in that section is usually a Purchase of Property, Equipment line. On almost all cash flow statements, this number includes all the capital expenditures, maintenance, and growth. Occasionally, as with Whole Foods, as we will see later, There are two lines, one for growth capital expenditures and one for all the rest of the capital expenditures, which we can assume is the maintenance capital expenditures. The good news is that I will have already read the notes to the cash flow statement when calculating the owner earnings, so this calculation simply builds on that work. Remember, these capital expenditures numbers are negative, so we add them as negatives to the net cash provided by operating activities number. The result is called free cash flow. Back to that paragon of capitalist excellence, the lemonade stand. Here is its free cash flow calculation. Net cash provided by operating activities, $2,800, plus purchase of property and equipment and other capital expenditures, negative $1,300. Free cash flow total, $1,500. Since we last checked, the lemonade stand has been investing in its growth. It bought new lemon squeezing equipment and opened a second stand across town. And the second location was doing even better than the first. There's always money in the lemonade stand. Its free cash flow grew by 16% for each of the last 2 years, and I confidently project that the growth rate will continue because the lemonade stand's brand moat is killer. Exclusive street corners and just the right amount of tartness in the lemonade. No one can beat it. A 16% windage growth rate is defensible. So, starting with the free cash flow of $1,500, I ran my numbers year by year to find out how much cumulative free cash flow the lemonade stand will give me in 8 years, the 8-year payback time. I multiplied $1,500 by 16% for each year, cumulatively going forward for 8 years. The full chart is on the PDF for reference. The payback time price I could pay for the lemonade stand was $24,778. Geez Louise, 16% per year really grows quickly. That's also a nice illustration of the power of compounding. For the lemonade stand, I had the 10 cap price of $28,000 and the 8-year payback time price of $24,778. I saw what my dad was talking about in the beginning when he described the three methods of pricing. With these multiple prices, each a data point, I was getting a good sense of the range from which I could choose what my buy price would be. I then practiced the 10 cap and the payback time on the real thing, a real company, Whole Foods. These figures are written out on the PDF as well. Whole Foods 2015 free cash flow. Net cash provided by operating activities. $1,129,000,000 plus development cost of new locations, negative $516,000,000 plus other property and equipment expenditures, negative $335,000,000. Free cash flow total, $278,000,000. Note, Whole Foods is one of the few companies that calculates free cash flow in their financial statements. See page 22 of their 2015 10K. Whole Foods' 8-year payback time buy price. After looking at its growth rates, which were a bit all over the place, I checked analysts' projections and saw they were around 14%. I went with it. Grew the $278 million of free cash for 8 years by 1.14, and came up with an 8-year payback time price of $4.2 billion. See Whole Foods payback time in the appendix. The 10 cap for Whole Foods was $9.81 billion. The 8-year payback time price was roughly $4.2 billion, lower than the 10 cap because of the major expenditures for new locations. With this huge difference, how would I decide? Remember our 3 points of data that will keep you safe? My dad asked on our investing practice call. Time for the third. Margin of safety. The margin of safety would value the entire company, not only put a price on it, as the first two methods had done. I wanted to learn it, but I still had not touched valuations since putting down that giant valuation tome Nuno had given me. The valuation of an entire company was a beast of a different color. and remembering that, I felt a bit shaky in my solar plexus. Complexity around math was where my dad and I sometimes had, shall we say, communication issues. At the same time as the shakes, though, a new feeling of confidence emerged from somewhere deep, and it soothed me. We had made it through two methods of pricing. I smiled to myself as that sank in. Only one method to go. July practice. Make practicing pricing as easy on yourself as possible. Choose three companies you like and calculate the 10 cap price and payback time price for each one. Reward yourself by bragging to someone who will appreciate it that you just used Buffett's special calculation of owner earnings to price a company. Chapter 8, Charlie's Fourth Principle, Value. August. This month. Margin of safety valuation method. Earnings per share, windage growth rate, windage PE ratio, minimum acceptable rate of return, MARR, or MAR. The air conditioner in my house was trying valiantly to fight the heat, blowing without a break, but even it wasn't quite up to the challenge posed by August in Boulder. I was tired of the heat, tired of work, tired of all the back-and-forth travel, and I was really tired of missing Nuno when we were forced to be apart. It felt like a chunk was ripped out of my chest, then band-aided back in when we were together, and then ripped right out again when one of us got on the inevitable airplane. And I was flying again, to Zurich, for a ridiculously short weekend. It was getting silly. Worst of all, it was the worst month of investing practice with the worst math. I wasn't afraid of it anymore, but I was tired. I wanted to skip this month of the worst part of my practice. Even putting my hot laptop on my legs was annoying. I rolled my eyes at myself. Just get on with it, I thought. I would have paid money to avoid it. But when you're waiting to see if someone shows up for you, you have to show up for yourself. That's just how it works. I wanted to be that successful investor self that I could see in my mind's eye. And I knew now that I could do it after probing the dark fog of a few months earlier. I had found companies with missions I adored. I had faced my preconceptions around money. I had faced pricing. Now, learning this month's math was required, I reminded myself. Get up and get on with it. It's math. It's not brain surgery. I wanted to learn how to value the whole business, I told myself, Trey convincingly. I noticed suddenly that the way I was thinking about my investing practice had changed. It was no longer something terrifying and unknown and filled with dire implications. Rather, this month's practice was simply something to be learned and internalized by doing the work. I did not feel the enclosed concrete stairwell feeling at all. It was a little bit less of math and a little bit more of math. Plain old math. I smiled to myself. Yes, there was some fluttering in my chest when I thought about the math, but I also felt confident that I would learn it. That investor chick in my mind would know the math, obviously, and my job was to become her. I wanted to learn how to value an entire business. I really did. My dad and I jumped on our video call in the evening Zurich time, midday Atlanta time. I now have two ways to put a price on the business, but I still don't know how to find the real value of the business. I opened the floor. Lay it on me. How do you value a whole company? Remember Charlie's fourth principle? A price that makes sense. You might have missed that he also used the words margin of safety. Buffett says that those are the three most important words in investing. We only buy when the price gives us a margin of safety. The margin of safety is a price below the company's value that will protect us from most mistakes. Not all, but most. A margin of safety is key, just in case I got my price analysis wrong. The business lawyer in me was hyper aware that public companies may have a lot going on that little guy investors like me don't know about. People make mistakes. People do bad stuff. People lie. Especially when there's big money and a good reputation at stake. Executives can have motives that are different from the motives and aims of public shareholders. No one can be completely certain about any company's future production. An inherent risk of investing is the information asymmetry between a company and its investors. All investors can do is try to invest in businesses we understand. If you're as comfortable with the business as you are with your condo investment, and buy at a price with a margin of safety, you'll be okay. Do the 10 cap and payback time have a margin of safety? That margin of safety is built into both. The 10 cap requires a return that is very high. That means the buy price must be very low and therefore has a big margin of safety. The payback time price gets us our money back in 8 years, roughly half of what the same business would sell for if it was public, and therefore about a 50% margin of safety. So, the 10 cap and payback time were pricing methods with a margin of safety built in. Now, I would learn a valuation method with a margin of safety built in. A note about per share numbers. Whole company numbers are different from per share numbers. I still treat the margin of safety method as though I'm buying the whole company. However, as we saw with Whole Foods, public company numbers are huge, often in the billions, which makes the math unwieldy. To alleviate that problem for public companies, and because in practical reality, potential investors, not us, generally only care about the shares they are buying, the financial industrial complex divides the whole company numbers into per share numbers. This is helpful, but be aware always of whether you're using per share numbers or whole company numbers. Either one is totally fine, as long as you're consistent within your formula. Financial people often switch back and forth between whole company numbers and per share numbers, which is really irritating, and it can be really confusing. I try to always make sure I know which one I'm working with. Going forward, for all the examples in this margin of safety method, I will use per share numbers. Pricing method number 3, margin of safety. We've used owner earnings and free cash flow. And now in the third pricing method, we're switching to earnings. The margin of safety method calculates what I'd pay today to get years of future earnings and my risk of actually getting the money in the future. Let's start to understand the relationship between time and risk by thinking about what it's worth to you to put your investing money to work. The most obvious option is to put it somewhere really safe. What's the safest place you can think of? Dad asked. Under my bed? It could get stolen or burn up. Someplace safer than that. In the bank. Okay, pretty safe. But there's an even safer place. The safest place it can go is into a U.S. government treasury bond. Oh yeah, T-bills. That was my hoarding plan. Dad laughed. Right, and they represent the risk-free rate of return. If we're putting our money to work somewhere else, which is not risk-free, in the lemonade stand, for example, we need to be paid more than the risk-free rate, or else you might as well keep your money and enjoy using it instead of tying it up in an investment. So how can I figure out how much I need to get so that making the investment is worthwhile? There is a clever way to figure this out. Of course there is. I'm going to teach you a simplified version of what the financial industry calls discounted cash flow analysis, my dad started. That giant valuation book Nuno gave me, it was mostly about discounted cash flow analysis. I was not thrilled. The biggest problem with this method of pricing is figuring out the amount I'd invest today for money I'm going to get in the future. It would be silly for me to invest $100 today to get back the exact same amount in 10 years, right? My nemesis, inflation, had destroyed that genius hoarding idea. With it, that $100 won't buy as much in 10 years. Plus, there's the risk I won't get paid back at all. To handle the declining buying power of my money and the risk that I won't get it back, I have to invest less than $100 today to get $100 in 10 years. The question is, by how much? That's what the margin of safety valuation tells me. And yes, it is indeed a simplified version of discounted cash flow analysis, which I drop into casual conversation as much as possible to sound fancy. We need to use readily available mainstream numbers for this pricing method so we can compare our results with how the rest of the world values the company, since we'll be buying from others and selling to them. The important